Oh. Roll it.
Hello.
Hi.
Oh, I got nothing in my ears.
Yeah, me neither. Are we? Yeah, we're definitely going. I just don't hear anything. We're just not connected. That's why.
I believe kids have been screwing around down here.
So we are drinking something different for the pre-show. We are drinking a $50 wine.
$15 wine?
$50. This is, let me get the full name of it correctly.
Greg, you know, if you've been listening, you know, Greg was mentioning a Barolo wine as something he really likes. How many different ones have you had?
This would be the second.
Second. So you just had one that you thought was awesome.
Yeah.
It's a lot like a dry cab, but there's a lot of rich flavors going on it. It's a little more fruity, but really dry.
It's complex. This is the wine that I was saying is, you know, not a beginner wine. It's not a $15 wine. I mean, you could approach it like you would a $15 wine, but there's more to it than that. Or a $9 wine or something like that. Mm-hmm. So,
no, I'm enjoying it. It's pretty much right up my alley, those dry reds.
Very dry, really oaky. Goes really well with that pizza we had. I mean, just the tomatoes came out with it. So it's beautiful wine. Is it worth $50? Well, I think it's worth a one-time $50 thing if you were just like, hey, I'm going to spend $50 tonight, but it's not worth, you know, every week going out to get
$50. I mean, at the rate that I like, you know, the depth that I like wine, I like this, but I've also had $9 wines that are very similar, right? So I'm not appreciating the full $50 worth. And I think a lot of people will find that, you know, even wine experts will say you can have perfectly fine wines.
Mm, absolutely.
For $20.
Yeah, it's not Utopia level.
Right? It's a lot cheaper than Utopia, though. You got
not that much
three
cheaper.
Quarters of a liter for $50.
Yeah, that's
bucks.
True. That's true.
So, yeah, I mean,
apparently you can find this. The average price before taxes, $34. Said this I got in Ohio for $50. If I were to get this in Maryland or find a place in Pittsburgh to get this, it would probably be around $65-$70.
Probably. Especially the Pennsylvania taxes and whatnot.
Yeah. So
Mike seems messed up today.
So yeah, who got some good news work-wise and so decided to spend $200 on beer and has two thumbs?
Beer.
This guy.
Wine. Sake.
Beer, wine, yeah.
So hop candies.
Not this shit. Yeah, the hop candies were four for a dollar.
Okay.
So I got eight of each kind. So. So I got some sake. So the next show or the show after that will be a sake show.
We need to go in the hop candy business. Quarter a piece.
Yeah.
It only costs a fraction.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure. But then you have to wrap them individually.
Mm.
And that will either take time or a machine to do that.
Right. Yeah, I was just thinking about the material. Okay, we need to make our own hop candies. How about that?
Sure. But we need to then experiment with them because those were, I mean, you know, they had good hot flavor without getting either too sugary or too bitter or too resiny.
They had a lot of hop flavor. I'm not sure if they'd say they have good hop flavor. They tasted pretty much like a hop tea, right?
I mean, there wasn't
too much complexity there other than, let's take some hop pellets, let's make a tea.
I don't think you'd make a sugar pellet hop thing with a lot of complexity, because if you did, you wouldn't want to keep it in your mouth for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So there's trade-offs to go with, right?
Sure.
But I think that for the trade-offs, you know, it was a decent hop candy thing, and that probably takes a lot of experimentation to get right.
Yeah, it could be true. I you know, if I was in the hop candy business, I would look for a way to make it not taste so green, make it taste more citrusy, floral, more like IPA than hop tea.
But I think the problem is then you're introducing something other than hops, because in order to make it like IPA, you need to have malt character there. You can't just have an IPA with hops. You are making, it's essentially a hop tea with maybe some sugar.
Well, sure. I mean, that's what that company does, that person does. But you could do other things. You could try to accentuate only the citrus flavors of a hops or something like that.
You could try. I'd like to see you try. I challenge you.
No, I'm not going to do it. I don't have time for that. I don't even have time to make a regular beer, let alone candy beer.
Candy beer.
Man, candy beer. Mm.
Speaking of candy beer, one of tonight's beers is a bacon and maple beer.
That's that donut one from Rogue, right?
Yep. It was there. It was a pink bottle. I had to buy it. Tonight is going to be the beers that Greg thought were like, what? Or,
Or, huh? Or, no way.
So,
a little sporting competition going on called the Olympics.
What?
What? No way.
The who?
So, what is your opinion of NBC's, the way they're running things?
My opinion is I honestly have not watched much of it at all, so whatever opinion I would give would be based on what I've read, so I don't have my own opinion on it.
You don't have your own opinion. Okay. So, for people that might not have their own opinion yet either, yeah, the internet is full of NBC fail hashtags.
Mm-hmm.
And this is mostly because they don't let you watch the marquee events live.
Right.
They want to package those up and show them during primetime when they make real money for advertisers. People were complaining that you should be able to watch the park. You can watch all kinds of stuff on NBCOlympics.com. All kinds of stuff. But you have to watch it while it runs live. And apparently, swimming and gymnastics aren't streamed, right? Those ones are being packaged. Right. I say apparently because I haven't double-checked, but that's what I've gathered from the complaints. I don't want to watch swimming or gymnastics online anyway. I want to watch skeet shooting, fencing, canoeing.
Yeah, the interesting stuff, the stuff that you don't see every 2 or 3 months in some competition somewhere. Yeah.
So I think you can see a ridiculous amount of awesome content on NBCOlympics.com. I don't have many complaints with that. But people are complaining that, you know, it's almost impossible to not get spoiled. You don't get spoilers. You cannot check up on what's happening in the world because there's a 5-hour, 6-hour delay or more.
Welcome to the internet, people. Yeah. This is
but you can't listen to radio news. You can't do anything. You can't be kept up and not find out what happens.
So you can't be, you can't have your up to the minute news that's constantly updated, so you have the very latest possible news possible in the entire world, and except at the same time,
be surprised at prime time.
Be surprised at prime time at the Olympics. Cry me a fucking river.
I'm not too worried about that. I'm not complaining. I've come to the realization that I'm not gonna have any surprises, but I'll watch the prime time Olympics just to see. But I'm gonna know what the results are anyway. Mm-hmm. NBC doesn't want you to know the results. They want you to tune in for all the commercial breaks. So people are complaining that they're withholding this stuff you can't watch, and it's going to get spoiled, and people don't have the opportunity to see it live. Some people are doing VPNs to the UK or DNS hackery to the UK so they can watch the BBC feed.
Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting way to go about it, because BBC is streaming everything live. My personal opinion is I don't hold that they saved the stuff for primetime against NBC. They paid $1 billion to get the Olympics. Mm-hmm. They got to make that back.
And they are making bank on the stuff that they're showing, right? I mean, they're making good ratings.
Yeah. They paid over $1 billion. They got to make their money back. My complaint is the packages they put together. They have a whole day's worth of Olympics that they want to squeeze into 4 hours of prime time, which most people know the results. There's not much suspense. There's no point in dragging people along for boring shit. They could put together a four-hour package of nonstop action. And it doesn't have to be just gymnastics and swimming. It can be all kinds of shit.
Right.
Put together a package of nonstop action, put in as many commercial breaks as you need, but everything else should be action. There shouldn't be downtime. No Ryan Seacrest talking about what people are saying on Twitter, you know, and shit like that. That's my complaint. Why isn't this more compelling prime time?
I mean, I think you're asking a lot of editors, but then again, you pay $1 billion for something, you should put the money into to get the editors to do it.
If they're going to make me not watch that stuff live and they want me to tune in for prime time, why are they putting together such a, why are they producing such a shitty
lazy package? Is what it is. And I think that's right. And I think that part of it is that, yeah, I mean, the only thing that people really seem to care about are the gymnastics and the swimming, and then the stuff that crosses somewhat our interest will be the track and field stuff next week.
Yeah. The personal interest pieces they do. I feel that they do that
to
keep the women watching.
Yeah, they're not for us.
But don't you think maybe lots of sports doesn't attract the women, but there's just so much downtime in the primetime broadcast. It just drives me insane.
Well, that's what DVRs are for. Yeah.
The only other complaint I have about the online stuff, and this is a small complaint, hardly a complaint. You tune into, you want to watch a skeet shooting. You tune in, and you're watching an almost empty stadium. And you're like, hasn't it started yet, or is it over? You don't know which, right? Because it's a non-edited, it's like a live feed, and they haven't turned off the camera yet, or they started the camera early, but you don't know which. So you're like, should I hang out here for 10 minutes, or is it over? You know, so that's a little frustrating.
See, the thing is, I've been very busy this week. I have been basically nonstop working on this project, so I have not had a whole lot of downtime to go and look at Olympic stuff. I was able to see the opening ceremonies at a friend's house, and then that was it. I really have not had much time at all to spend
on Olympic. If you watch it on your computer, there's the main screen and a preview screen, which is great, because then you can, before you actually flip to something, you can make sure something's going on. But when you're doing it on your phone, which is fucking magic shit, watch the Olympics live on your phone. It's insane. That's where it's a little more frustrating, because you have to flip to the new channel and there's nothing on. You're like,
well, only if you consider these a phone. These are not phones.
Well,
these are little computer screens. These are little computers.
By phone, I meant something that fits in your pocket.
Yeah.
But it's frustrating because you flip to the new channel, you have to watch a Citibank ad, and then there's nothing on.
Yeah.
But that's just a small complaint. It's like that whole Louis C.K. thing, right? Where, you know, we're the biggest generation of assholes because
everything's amazing and nobody's happy.
Pretty much. Yeah. And I admit, the Olympics on your phone, you can watch 30 different Olympic streams on your phone for free. Live.
We had to sit through a commercial, and then maybe you may get one that's already done. Oh.
Okay, one more complaint. It's the same fucking commercial every time you change a channel. Give me some variety. Give me.
Oh. Oh my God.
I do admit it's amazing. Freaking magic.
Well, I mean, that's the, you know, the thing about it is that if we didn't complain, things wouldn't get better, right?
Yeah.
If we had no complaints about it, if you're like, this is perfect, okay, it doesn't matter that I'm seeing the same thing all the time. It doesn't matter that I get no updates, blah, 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 blah. This is perfect. Then they have no reason to change, no reason to update. You're fine with it. So your complaints make things better.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my response to the Louis C.K. thing is that, I mean, yeah, I mean, I get it. Everything is amazing and no one is happy, but no one's happy because no one's ever happy, because if we were ever happy, animation would stop.
It's a great point. It's not as funny.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it just makes you stop and think, you know, because people do take the image, like, you know, you could see the top of your head on your phone, you know, from satellites, and you're bitching about it, you know, like, take that back 50 years, and, like, speaking of engineers and whatnot, the Mars Science Lab lands couple days?
Yes.
There was a thing on NPR this morning. The lead for the landing, descent and landing
ETL.
Team.
Yeah. Is it, what's his name?
Adam Aaron.
Adam, yeah, Adam Meisler, I think.
Yeah, similar to that, but he is an inspiration for everyone like me. I mean, kind of thing. The dude, you think you're working for NASA, you're in principal, not the principal, but you're the head of the landing team. You know, you figure he got straight A's through high school, you know, went through college, got his PhD, and, you know, went to NASA. No, this dude took geometry twice, and second time he passed geometry with an F+, because the teacher didn't want him in the class anymore. After high school, he was a rock, you know, like traveling, like playing bars, trying to do the rock and roll thing. And he was doing that for a while. And then, like, one night he was driving home from a gig and he was curious why Orion was in a different place in the sky than when he went to the gig at the beginning. And he knew something about vague, about movement, but he didn't know anything about it. It was just simply the rotation of Earth, but he didn't know the details about that. It drove him to go to a community college physics course. And from there, you know, he geeked out like Greg and I geek out. Like, you can figure out why things are, how things are, you know, and from there he got his PhD. So this dude who almost didn't graduate high school is a PhD in physics, and he is running the descent and landing team for the Mars Science Lab.
And did the EDL for the Spirit and Opportunity
Lab. Oh, did he? Yeah. He didn't mention that in this article, in this, you know, this little package on NPR, but I mean, I was like, I want to record this, play this for, like, just, like, don't give up. It's almost, it was almost inspiring, like, hey, it's not too late for me. I, you know, well, the kids, it makes it a little hard, but, you know, I could change tracks and still work, you know, be a space explorer at NASA if I wanted to. I don't know if I have the calculus chops, though. But that was it was a heck of a story. Look, if you want to hear it, Joe Palka, the guy that does those little science blips on NPR, produced the package, so you can look for him in his thing with the Mars Science Lab. It was a pretty good package.
Well, let's see.
Did you see that? Is it Toshiba? So whoever owns the big
Adam TV. Stelzner, is that who it is?
Yeah, Stelzner, that's it.
Yeah.
Big TV in Times Square, they're going to broadcast the descent and landing live.
Yeah. But the thing is, it's happening at 1:30 a.m. in the
morning. Oh. Well, I guess that's part of the reason they gave it away for free, huh? But I never really heard this or thought about it. But
yeah, NASA, you've seen the guy before. This is, yeah, he looks like an older rocker.
I'm not sure I've seen him before. I don't think I've seen him before. He actually looks like my sales rep at the Colo. But I don't think I've seen him before. He's definitely a bit of a hip, I don't know, hippie's the right word, but he's one of those Berkeley, California.
Yeah.
Child of a flower child, at least something like that, the way he talks and his, but it was very cool. And just, you know, like, wow. You know, dude who didn't, I mean, I turned on, you know, I didn't get school until like 10th or 11th grade. Even then I wasn't straight A's.
Mm-hmm.
This guy didn't get school at all and was able to do it years later, which is, I don't know, it's just, it's inspiring for those who don't get school.
Yeah. And, you know, he can, you can accomplish great things even if you didn't, even if you weren't the best student in the world. That isn't, you know, your permanent record is not going to be based on that.
I mean, he eventually became a good student. He has a PhD in physics, so he did buckle down after the rock thing. And it was interesting because Joe Palka was talking about, you know, so you liked the science, you liked being able to calculate and figure things out. Now, what about the space part of it? You know, would you have been happy designing sanitation, you know, sensation processing plants. He's like, I need a little bit of the sexy too, you know. I was in rock and roll, and that has a lot of sexy. And you know, I grew up in the '60s, you know, or I was born in the '60s and grew up, and you know, NASA was revered, so I definitely needed some of that sexy.
Have you seen the 7 Minutes of Terror video?
Yeah, I've seen the 7 Minutes of Terror video.
So he's in that video. And,
okay.
It's a very...
For people that might not know the 7 Minutes of Terror, it takes 7 minutes from basically entering the atmosphere to when it lands. And because of the lag time for radio signals, it takes 15 minutes for a radio signal to get back. So 7 minutes for landing is completely... Yeah, it's
automated,
smaller
100%
than
automated.
It's smaller than the resolution of us to communicate to him, right? So like, we know what's happening now, but we're not going to know for 15 minutes.
Yeah, well, so by the time it either lands or has been destroyed, 7 minutes will have passed.
Well, no, the 7 minutes of 7 minutes of terror is how long it actually takes.
Well, but I'm saying
If it had landed properly, they're not going to know for sure for 15 more minutes.
Right, but what I'm saying is that, you know, okay, so EDL starts at that 7 minute mark. So, you know, so roughly 7 minutes in is when it lands, or between that time it's destroyed.
Right.
We won't know. Let's say it lands. We won't know that it landed for another 7 minutes after.
No.
We won't know that it started. We won't know before another 7 minutes.
It'll be another 7 minutes before we make sure it started okay.
Right.
Because it's a 15-minute lag. A little over 15 minutes, I think. 15-minute lag.
Right. So by the time we get information that the signal has started, it will have already been on the ground at least 7 minutes if it landed correctly.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good way to put it. Now, here goes back to the question. Does it matter? Because there's no way to observe from here that it's actually happened, right? So the guys at NASA, I mean, other than a token, it started. Oh, they might be on the ground now. They're working 15 minutes late too, because that's really the real thing. Even though, but you know, the only thing is there's no triage, right? I mean, if something had gone wrong, there's no corrective action.
They had to put it in the code.
I mean, the only thing you're doing is a postmortem at that point.
Right. Well, I mean, yeah, but it matters in terms of you having to make sure that you have accounted for everything you can possibly think of that could happen in the code beforehand.
Right.
So that's how it matters. But yeah, at this point, it's just, you know, the computer does it. And you let it do its thing, and that's all you can do. All you can do is hope
in the,
that you accounted for everything you possibly could account
for. In
the
interview, Adam mentioned that, you know, it's bigger than me, it's bigger than 10 people, bigger than 20 people. He said at one point there was 2,000 people working on EDL. That's kind of insane. I think he meant EDL. He might have meant the whole project, but I'm pretty sure he meant EDL.
Well, I mean, I can imagine, because, for example, one of the things they had to do is they had to design an entirely new type of supersonic parachute with new material science. Mm-hmm. You know, they had to test that. And so you're talking about people who design the materials, people who are involved in the test chambers, stuff like that. You know, all the people involved in that, you would count those people. Even if you're just the guy who, you know, is the manager of the facility that does the air for a whole bunch of different stuff in that air tunnel, but they're testing it in that tunnel. They're testing the supersonic parachute in that tunnel now, so that guy gets counted. So yeah, I mean, I can see how that gets.
Yeah, I guess you're right. I was imagining a project where you have 2,000 code monkeys all submitting code.
Yeah, that's not gonna happen. Oh my.
Yeah, so I guess you'd put it in a little more, you know, appropriate light. I was thinking like 2,000 engineers all working, but not engineers. There's lots of people that are supporting. There's payroll.
Yeah.
There's accounting. There's
guys who press the buttons, do the things. I don't know whether they're actually counting the accounting people, but they definitely are counting. Yeah. Like I said, the guy who manages that building that does the that is the wind tunnel that tests a whole bunch of other things, but they also test the supersonic parachute. They're definitely counting that guy. That guy gets counted a lot.
Now, I'm wondering how they test the retro rockets and account for the reduced gravity.
There are a couple ways you can do that. One of the ways is you test, obviously, retro rockets on Earth, but with more thrust, and you downgrade. The other thing is that you put them on a platform that has
so the platform has rockets that are decelerating at a rate to make your
not necessarily rockets, but the platform is connected to a thing that is reducing the weight and the lift, so such that it
and you have to have that in a vacuum chamber.
No, it's not a vacuum.
Well, but you have
it's
to
a,
have...
It's close to a vacuum. It's not a vacuum.
I mean, it's still a vacuum chamber to reduce the air pressure, right? Because rockets are going to perform differently based on the density
I'm sure they tested the
density of the material the exhaust hits, right? So you're going to have to test this whole simulated gravity thing inside a chamber that has
simulated atmosphere. No, the rockets are not going to perform that much differently in a vacuum. The rockets themselves may perform differently in a vacuum, but in terms of how much thrust they were giving, that's an F equals MA thing. That's just the reason why rockets go is not because they're pushing air down, it's because they're accelerating something out of the back of them.
Oh. Yeah, you're right. I was confusing a little bit of jet engine, a little bit of rocket, I guess. Yeah, because rockets work in a vacuum, and they're not pushing against anything. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Still, testing for an alien land, especially something with active rockets and it's going to be awesome. And it sure would suck if the MSL crashes.
It would suck. But I have confidence. Confidence born out of... Yeah, the accomplishments.
Now, they say like half of all missions to Mars have failed, but I think Russia is soaking up a lot of those failures. Right?
Russia, and there are some U.S. failures in there, but none that have had, the very first Mars polar lander failed. That was right after Mars Pathfinder. But then they kind of got their act together and they did MER and... Mm-hmm. This is kind of going off of, a lot of the considerations they did with MER. I mean, they really went over this significantly. And they had their other, the Mars Phoenix, which was the other version of the Polar Lander, which worked fine. And I think they covered their bases as much as they could on this one. Because a lot of the future of NASA depends on this, I think.
Right. I'm sorry for the dead air. I thought I could do a quick search for failed Mars missions and get a nice, concise list.
Just Wikipedia. There's a whole list. Anyway, we should probably get to the show. What do you think?
Sure, sounds good.
All right. Here come the beers.
The bears.
Duh.